On This Week in Enterprise Tech, we have Mr. Brian Chi and Mr. Curtis Franklin here today. Now, there was a huge hit on internet traffic this past week when Facebook decided to just disconnect their data centers from the internet. There may be a good lesson there on what not to do in infrastructure management. We'll definitely get into that. Plus, today we have a returning guest because we always have a great conversation with her, Triveni Gandhi. She's Senior Industry Data Scientist, Life Sciences, and Responsible AI at Data IQ. We're going to talk about ethical AI. Plus, she may just be able to answer for us whether there's a link between AI governance, ML ops, and responsible AI. You definitely shouldn't miss it. It's Wyatt on the set.
Podcasts you love
from people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twit, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 464, recorded October 8th, 2021. Three laws of AI. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by CrowdStrike. CrowdStrike harnesses the power of every click, every action, and every ally to grow stronger and stop cyber threats before they can stop you. Join the fight and experience the power of Falcon Platform for free today at CrowdStrike.com/twit. And by Compiler, an original podcast from Red Hat discussing tech topics big, small, and strange. Listen to Compiler on Apple Podcasts or anywhere you listen to podcasts. And by FlexTrack, the powerful yet simple security management platform that helps you to get the real cybersecurity work done. With FlexTrack, you'll streamline your assessments, analytics, and reporting. Visit FlexTrack.com/twit and claim your free month. Welcome to Twit, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how this world is connected. I'm your host, Louis Maresca, your guide through this big world of the enterprise. But I definitely can't guide you by myself. I need to bring in the professionals, the experts in their field, starting with our very own network and security expert. He is an all-around tech geek as well, and he's Mr. Brian Chi. Chibert, how are you, my friend?
I'm doing great, thank you. And I'm actually playing with some really cool new software, well, relatively new software called Speedify, and it allows me to load balance across multiple WAN links so that if I happen to be traveling and the hotel Wi-Fi is only so-so, I can actually augment it with the 5G and hopefully get more than enough bandwidth to be able to stream 4K.
Ooh, very nice, very nice to get some of that as well. Thank you, Chi. Well, welcome him. Welcome back. Well, of course, we also have to welcome back our very own security and enterprise expert. He's a senior analyst at Omdia, and he's Mr. Curtis Franklin. Curtis, how are you doing, my friend, and what's keeping you busy?
Lou, it has been a great couple of weeks. Glad to be back after being off doing some research last week. This week I spent time with VMware at their virtual global user conference. Next week I'm doing the same thing with Splunk. So it's the season of vendor user conferences. Looking forward to some more of those, getting ready for a great deal of research that I'm going to be doing, sort of wrapping up the year. It's hard to believe that we're already talking about things for the end of the year, and also talking about a webinar that I'm going to be presenting in November on the use of gamification in cybersecurity awareness training. I'll have the link out on my Twitter feed within the next few days and would love for people to show up and put me on the spot with lots of good Twit Riot questions.
Well, thanks, Kurt, for being here. Well, we have quite the busy week in the enterprise, so we definitely should get started. Now, there was a huge hit on internet traffic this past week when Facebook just decided, you know, disconnect their data centers from the internet. Big problem there. Now, there may be a good lesson on what not to do in infrastructure management. We'll definitely go through everything there. Plus, we have a returning guest. That's right. She gave us such an amazing information last time, and we had such fun talking to her. We had to have her back. That's right. We have Triveni Gandhi. She's Senior Industry Data Scientist, Life Sciences, and Responsible AI at Data IQ. We're going to talk about ethical AI. Plus, she may be able to answer whether there is a link between AI governance, ML ops, and responsible AI. So sit tight. We have lots more to talk about. We do. Let's go ahead and jump into this week's news blips. Now, over the past couple of years, we've seen advancements in CPUs and the many different architectures that exist. However, there's been a lack of movement around the rest of the components of machines out there, most notably the PCI standards of the machine. Now, PCIe typically links up microprocessors, GPUs, I/O devices, and data storage in the systems, ranging from home PCs to cloud servers and some embedded devices. Now, PCIe 5.0 machines were released back in 2019 with the promise from the PCI special interest group that they would have a set plan to speed up the development and release of successive PCIe standards. Well, 2 years later, and good news, PCIe 6.0 is close, and it promises that data transfer speeds can almost double. That's right. The 6.0 spec supports up to 64 gigatransfers per second, which in practical terms means about 128 gigs per second per direction in the X16 configuration, which is double that of PCIe 5. Now, by comparison, PCIe 1.0, which was released in 2003, had a transfer rate of just 4 gigabits per second per direction on the X16 lane. Now, PCIe 6.0 technology bandwidth capabilities are more suited for high-end applications at this time, like accelerators, machine learning, and HPC applications that need high I/O bandwidth. Now, the protocol has gained a low-latency data error correction mechanism called forward error correction, in addition to CRC, to make the increased bandwidth actually viable here. Now, it also, interestingly enough, uses PAM4 encoding, which is seen in fast Ethernet in GDDR6X. Now, it will take almost 12 months before we start to see production machines implementing this new spec, but at least you and your organization have a time frame and a North Star for your next upgrades.
We'll get ready to learn a new name for malware. Fountain Lake is targeting Linux systems. Researchers at ESET have found a previously unknown malware family dubbed Fountain Lake, targeting systems running Linux. The first known Fountain Lake file appeared on VirusTotal in May of 2020, and other samples were uploaded throughout the year. Both the location of its CNC server, that's command and control, and the countries from which samples were uploaded to VirusTotal indicate that the attacker's targets include and are focused on Southeast Asia. Now, according to the researchers, Fountain Lake uses custom and well-designed modules, and modules used by the malware family are constantly under development and provide remote access to the operators, collect credentials, and serve as a proxy server. The malware family's known components include Trojanized applications, backdoors, and rootkits, which interact with each other in a particular malicious way. Now, researchers found multiple Trojanized applications, mostly used to load custom backdoor or rootkit modules. The three backdoors discovered are written in C++. The functionality they have in common is that each exfiltrates collected credentials and its bash command history to that C2 server.
In a groundbreaking initiative announced by the Department of Justice this week, federal contractors will be sued if they fail to report a cyber attack or data breaches. The newly introduced Civil Cyber Fraud Initiative will leverage the existing False Claims Act to pursue contractors and grant recipients involved in what the DOJ calls cybersecurity fraud. Usually, the False Claims Act is used by the government to tackle civil lawsuits over false claims made in relation to federal funds and property connected with government programs. Well, cyber contractors have chosen silence for much too long. Quote, for too long, companies have chosen silence under the mistaken belief that it is less risky to hide a breach than to bring it forward and to report it, according to Deputy Attorney General Lisa Monaco, who is pioneering the initiative. Well, that changes today. We are announcing today that we'll use our civil enforcement tools to pursue companies, those who are government contractors who receive federal funds when they fail to follow required cybersecurity standards, because we know that puts us all at risk. Well, this is a tool that we have to ensure that taxpayer dollars are used appropriately and guard the public fiscal responsibilities. Well, the introduction of the Cyber Fraud Initiative is the direct result of the department's ongoing thorough review of the cybersecurity landscape ordered by the Deputy Attorney General last May. The goal behind these review activities is to develop actionable recommendations that enhance and expand the DOJ's efforts to combat cyber threats. The launch of the initiative aims to curb new and emerging cybersecurity threats to sensitive and critical systems by bringing together subject matter experts from civil fraud, government procurement, and cybersecurity agencies. The development comes at a time when cyber attacks are rampant and advanced ransomware gangs repeatedly target critical infrastructures such as the Colonial Pipeline and healthcare facilities. Well, the reality is if you're a contractor doing work for the U.S. government, such disclosures are just part of any federal contract anyway, and certainly part of any classified work. So if you're actually playing by the rules, this isn't really a change, or is it time to clean house? Your choice.
Now, this may not be news to you, but there is a definite majority stakeholder detected in state-backed hacks over the last year. Can you guess it? Well, that's right. Russia accounted for most state-sponsored hacking detected with a 58% share, mostly targeting government agencies and think tanks in the United States, followed by Ukraine, Britain, and European NATO members. Now, the devastating effectiveness of the long undetected SolarWinds hack, it mainly breached information technology businesses, including Microsoft, also boosted Russian state-backed hackers with a success rate of 32% in the year ending June 30th compared to 21% in the preceding 12 months. Now, China, meanwhile, accounted for fewer than 1 in 10 of the state-backed hacking attempts, but was successful 44% of the time. So a little bit more effective there. Now, a new report by Microsoft details some of those hacks. Now, you may be wondering, is there a pattern to these hacks? Well, according to the report, state-backed hacking is chiefly about intelligence gathering, whether for national security or commercial or strategic advantage, and thus generally tolerated by governments with U.S. cyber operators among the most skilled. Now, Russian hack attempts were up from 52% in 2019 to 2020 period for the year ending June 30th. Now, North Korea was second as country of origin at 23%, up from less than 11% previously. Now, China actually dipped to 8% from 12%. Now, after the SolarWinds attack was discovered in December, the Russians transitioned back to focusing mostly on government agencies involved in foreign policy, defense, and national security. Now, that was followed by think tanks and healthcare, where they targeted organizations developing and testing COVID-19 vaccinations and treatment in the United States, Australia, Canada, Israel, India, and Japan. Now, in the report, Microsoft said Russian state hackers had a greater efficacy in recent months. Now, the question is, will that mean even higher impact compromises in the year ahead? Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, the bites. But before we get to those great bites, we do have to thank a really great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's CrowdStrike. Now, you may have seen the headlines, and we talk about it all the time here on Twit. Ransomware attack after ransomware attack holding businesses hostage. It can feel like it's only a matter of time before they come for you, and you'll have to decide, do you pay or do you lose everything? Well, but there could actually be a third option. Do you defeat your adversaries before the fight even starts? With CrowdStrike, you're not alone in the battle against ransomware. A secure future demands a shared defense, and that's why CrowdStrike's Falcon platform uses their threat graph powered by advanced AI to analyze behavior on your devices, servers, and cloud workflows to fight the threats and stop them. Now, their security platform delivers the industry's most powerful set of tools to fight today's most sophisticated cyber attacks, all delivered via the cloud through a lightweight, intelligent agent. Now, Forrester study finds Falcon Complete delivers. In fact, it has a 403% return on investment with 100% confidence. Now, we talked with CTO Mike Sintonis, and he explained how the Threat Graph system is a collaborative platform.
It's the crowd in CrowdStrike, and that's the concept. You know, the original vision was to build the fundamentals. It was to bring in all of those signals, that telemetry, and the more data we get, the more information that we have. We can use that to protect all of our customers in real time.
CrowdStrike harnesses the power of every click, every action, and every ally to grow stronger and stop cyber threats before they can stop you. Now, Falcon Complete stops breaches every hour of every day through their expert management, threat hunting, monitoring, and remediation, and it's backed by CrowdStrike's breach prevention warranty. They don't just say it, they guarantee it for Falcon Complete managed customers who receive a warranty covering up to $1 million in the event of a breach. Terms and conditions apply there. Gartner Magic Quadrant named CrowdStrike a leader for endpoint protection platform for 2021. Join the fight and experience the power of Falcon Platform for free today at CrowdStrike.com/twit. That's CrowdStrike.com/twit. CrowdStrike, because what we've built together is worth defending together. And we thank CrowdStrike for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's time for the Bytes. Now, over the last week, we saw a very large social networking company and service company be susceptible to downtime due to infrastructure management. Now, if you use Facebook, Instagram, and WhatsApp, or even work for Facebook and tried to use your smart card to get into their building, you may be aware that they essentially disappeared from the global internet. The question is, was it due to usual suspects in networking that caused the large outage? Gebert, what's going on? What's going through there?
Well, let's look at the script. This actually sounded a lot like a really bad science fiction B movie. When the heroes are trying to rush into the building to fix things, but their card keys don't work. They got locked out. Well, so Doug Madori is a director of internet analysis at Kentik, a San Francisco-based network monitoring company. And Madori said approximately 11:39 a.m. Eastern, someone at Facebook caused an update to be made to the company's border gateway protocol records. BGP is a mechanism by which internet service providers of the world share information about which providers are responsible for routing internet traffic to which specific groups of internet addresses. Well, the Krebs on Security article basically uses this analogy. In simpler terms, sometime this morning, Facebook took away the map telling the world's computers how to find its various online properties. As a result, when one types Facebook.com into a web browser, the browser has no idea where to find Facebook.com and so returns an error message. Well, this requires a little storage story. BGP, the Boundary Gateway Protocol, is similar to a menu of some sort or even a set of a table of numbers. So if you choose a number between 1 and 200, well, 1 and quite a big number, what happens is you're telling the world how to get to a particular set of addresses and domains. So if you choose a bad number, what happens is like what happened to me about 10, 15 years ago. I tried to download a set of drivers, a new set of drivers from a company that was literally only a mile and a half away from me, away from the University of Hawaii. But I was transiting between the .edu world and the .com world. Now, normally, I would have been able to cross over between the two worlds at an exchange point out by Honolulu International Airport. Would have worked great. But someone fat-fingered the BGP change, and instead of crossing over at the Hawaii Internet Exchange out by the airport, I crossed over in Chicago, Illinois. So I was going, why is this FTP taking so long? And I finally did a trace route, and I traced route right through Chicago. Now, one of the other things that hit that was really interesting, I was at a press conference with Satya Nadella talking about this new set of really cool facilities in Server 2012 R Release 2. And that's when he dropped this bombshell on us. He said, server can now talk BGP. And a gazillion hands went up almost immediately saying, what, how are you going to protect someone from, oh, let's try this, and routing the entire traffic for the internet through a tiny little ISP, say in Portland. And almost that exact thing happened to an ISP in China that made a bad choice and routed a large portion of the internet traffic through that tiny little ISP and brought the network to its knees. Now, one of the other things that I should point out in the Krebs story is the Facebook employees couldn't even get into their buildings because apparently their card key system was cloud-based. And with the cloud, scanning your card means it goes to the cloud, supposed to go and do its authentication, make sure everything's going, and then send back a response, an encoded response to the card key system to unlock the door. Well, if BGP is broken, then you can't find the cloud. You can't find the cloud that's in the Facebook.com world. And it's not just Facebook.com. It was WhatsApp and Instagram. So a lot of things broke. Now, let's go to the next article. This one goes into a lot more detail. This one is from datacenterfrontier.com. Now, these guys started, and for those people that are audio only listening to this, it's worth finding that URL because they go into some really good detail on what happened. You know, how does this, you know, how does such a thing happen? And the reality is BGP is all about trust. Now, it's not a computer-to-computer trust yet. There is a new version of BGP where it has to exchange encryption keys, but it's not that widespread yet. Now, what a lot of people don't realize is the best BGP geeks on Earth also are really good at making friends. So when I worked with the folks at Interop, all the Interop BGP geeks, they had the personal cell phone numbers of the upstream ISPs. In some cases, the trust relationship was big enough that they had delegated rights to go in and modify the upstream routers. And that came in really, really handy when the Interop show got hit by Slammer. We were not only able to characterize it and apply access control list profiles on all our routers, our router geeks were then able to do the same thing to the ISPs upstream from us. Well, there's a problem with human error on this type of thing, and well, it's going to be interesting. So one of the things I wanted to do is throw this to Mr. Kurt. And Kurt, one of the big problems with BGP is the level of trust required with folks upstream and downstream of you and your crossover points, aka the exchanges. A malcontent could do some really serious harm to business. Should coalitions be formed to formalize this relationship between the router geeks? And do you think corporate America would even allow this to happen?
Well, you know, to answer those in reverse order, I think corporate America would allow it to happen because, let's face it, knocking yourself off of the internet doesn't give you a competitive advantage. So this is one of those things sort of like the communication between cybersecurity teams that is allowed both by corporate governance and by the government. Most security communications between teams has been defined as falling outside of the laws that might otherwise be tripped up by words like collusion. You know, it is in everyone's best interest for there to be a level of transparency, trust, and communications when it comes to all this. Now, BGP is one of those things. It is one of the basic protocols of the internet. And like so many of our other protocols, you know, we can think about NTP and DNS. It was designed and engineered for a much simpler time when it was possible to actually know many of the people who might be your network neighbors and have those personal relationships. Now it's much more difficult. And I think if there is going to be any sort of redesign or communications, then we have to basically figure out a way to prevent people from fumble fingering BGP. You know, in risk management terms, this is one of those events where there is a low probability, but high consequences. And that means that it really must be taken into account when you're doing your risk analysis. You know, I think a lot of security people were breathing a sigh of relief when they heard that this was not some sort of external attack or even an internal attack. As far as we know, it was an accident. But that doesn't mean that all of the cybersecurity folks are completely absolved of caring about this. It really did strike at the integrity, availability, and general consistency of the data, and therefore, it's a security issue. There are a lot of lessons to be learned from this, and I'm sure people are going to be unpacking it for a while, but the big thing is if you're in security, make sure you know what the windows are for major network infrastructure updates and be sure that you have a say in just what's going on in the environment around them. Believe me, your board will thank you.
Well, great. I like that. And let's bring out another oldie story from Interop. Again, Slammerworm hits Interop. Brings down the network. Well, one of the things that we did and that I learned and applied with the military is out-of-band networks need to be completely out-of-band. We actually called it Access Ether. And the reality is we Interop actually ran a physically air-gapped network whose only purpose was to provide management and security access to the devices that made up the Interop net. Now, while it sounds like a really, really, really great idea, this is where management has gotten in the way at oh so many large networks around the world. Well, what's wrong with running a separate VLAN? You know, you can put your management and it's still separate. You're still doing what you want to do, but it's on the same switches. And while I don't know what happened, Jay Maley in the chat room gave me a nice statement saying, according to their statement, they weren't actually making a change to BGP at the time. Quote, a command was issued with the intention to assess the availability of global backbone capacity, which unintentionally took down all the connections in their backbone networks, effectively disconnecting Facebook data centers globally. Our systems are designed to audit commands like this to prevent mistakes like this, but a bug in that audit also happened. Thank you, Jay. Oh, I'm sorry, Nally. I misread that. Anyway, one of the things that I get on a soapbox a lot is when you start doing your switch upgrades for your enterprise, don't get rid of the old switches. I upcycle them or whatever verb you want. I use the old switches to create an air-gapped network strictly for security devices and out-of-band management. That way, say, for God forbid, another something like Slammer hits where it wipes out your in-band bandwidth so that you can no longer get to your switches. But little clue, serial and USB now and dedicated Ethernet that are designed for management have priority on network devices. So what that does is it says your in-band might be completely swamped, but your network management people can still get in and have priority to be able to say, shut down the public-facing interfaces and do a true out-of-band management system, fix things, add ACLs, and go for it. Gumby, yes. Sadly, very few people actually do true out-of-band links. I will many, many times for even remote locations, say like on top of volcanoes when we have microwave links, I actually will have LTE modems from people like Lantronics or Open Gear where they aren't even on my network. My only access to them is through a cellular modem, but they're connected to my routers, to my radios and so forth through a serial link so that I have my last ditch. Oh my God, everything else is broken way to get into my switches and my equipment without having to drive 2 hours to the top of the mountain in a four-wheel drive. Gumby, thank you very much for that comment. So, Lou, I'm not going to put you on the spot on this one only because I really, really, really want to ask whether Server 2012 was just the beginning and whether Microsoft has designed in more safety features. I'm just going to say if Lou could talk about this, they probably have. I just haven't heard from it because unfortunately the server division doesn't do press junkets like they used to, where we used to be able to get people like Satya Nadella to come and talk to us and tell us about the really cool things that are happening. So I keep my great wish for Microsoft public relations is start having those press meetings again. Being able to see behind the curtain makes it so that we can do really interesting articles, kind of like this one. But anyway, Lou, we're starting to run out of time. And instead of me putting you on the spot, how about we go think about talking to one of our sponsors or talking about one of our sponsors and get to our favorite part of the show.
Absolutely. Thank you, Cheever. I appreciate you not putting me on the spot there. Yeah, so we definitely have a much, much interesting part of the show left over here. We're going to bring in our guests to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Wrap. But before we do, we do have to thank another great sponsor of this week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Compiler, an original podcast from Red Hat discussing tech topics big, small, and strange. The Compiler comes to you from the makers of Command Line Heroes, another of our sponsors, and is hosted by Angela Andrews and Brent Simoneau. Now, technology can be big, bold, bizarre, and complicated. Now, Compiler unravels industry topics, trends, and the things you've always wanted to know about tech through interviews with the people who know it best. Now, on their show, you'll hear a chorus of perspectives from the diverse communities behind the code. Now, Compiler brings together a curious team of Red Hatters to tackle big questions in tech, like what is a technical debt? What are tech hiring managers actually looking for? And do you have to know how to code to get started in open source? Now, the first episode covers a topic of much debate in the tech world. Should managers code? It's a good one, actually. And jumping into the fix to fix the problem can be actually very seductive. Now, in the episode of Compiler, you'll hear from a manager who has learned that supporting his team to fix the problem rather than doing it himself might be slower, but can lead to better results. Now, a managerial position is seen as a milestone of working life. Suddenly, a person who worked on code before begins to step back from those day-to-day tasks. What does that mean? What started as an internal email at Red Hat blossomed into a much deeper discussion about career growth and what can be caught in its wake. Have you ever walked into an interview and been asked to work through a coding problem on a whiteboard? I know I have here. If you were hired, how much do you actually do spend time in front of a whiteboard for a job? Well, and how do you interview for a technical position? Red Hatters cast a skeptical eye towards the dreaded whiteboard interview, but discover that it can actually have some real benefits. Now, I checked out the episode Should Managers Code and found it very, very enlightening. In fact, I had a lot of different perspective compared to some of the actual people on the show. So definitely take a listen to that one. It's very, very interesting. Now, episodes are out now. Go and download them at any time and be sure to check back for new shows. Now, listen to Compiler on Apple Podcasts or anywhere you listen to your podcasts. We'll also include a link on the episode's show page. My thanks to Compiler for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's my favorite part of the show. We actually get to bring in a guest to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Riot. And today we have Triveni Gandhi. She's Senior Industry Data Scientist Life Sciences and Responsible AI at Data IQ. Jervaini, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Lou. Thanks so much for having me back.
Now, we had so much fun having you on last time. We talked a lot about AI and ML. So we wanted to get a lot. We had a lot more tech topics to talk there. But since we may have some new audience members, can you tell the folks at home, maybe give them a quick journey through tech and what brought you to Data IQ?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So I started my career as a disillusioned academic. So I did a PhD in political science. And then I said, this is not going to work for me. I did a few years at a nonprofit in New York City doing data pipelining, and then came to Data IQ, where I've been working with customers on our enterprise software for end-to-end data science. And so working with customers from small, medium, large, you know, on a number of topics. And while there, I've been really interested in the responsible AI space, understanding the effects of what we're building. And so now I'm more into this, into a specialized role, looking at responsible AI broadly, and then also life science topics and how to execute them on our platform.
Fantastic. Now, you know, the last time we talked a lot about how organizations were getting started. They're starting to use machine learning models to produce better insights. And a lot, you see it in different parts of the industry. We see it in banks. We see it in customer service, retail. You name it, we see it. But there's some challenging aspects to it. There's lots of the way you have to handle data, the way you have to manage and scale out your offerings. Now, can you take us through maybe some of the trends you're seeing in organizations and what they actually have to think about when it comes to developing these models and actually using AI in their business?
Yeah, I think there's three components that we have to think about. One is, do we even have the data available, right? Can we access this? And this was something that maybe the average company was thinking about two or three years ago. Okay, well, now we've got the data. What do we do with it, right? How do we actually start working with it? And that was something that we were looking at about a year or two ago. And now the question really is, how do we get value out of it? That's where we're at, I think, at this point in time. How do we get value out of all of this data? I can build a model, I can build XYZ predictions, but how is it driving my underlying business line? And I think, if you will allow me to predict for the future, I think where we're going is, okay, I have the data, I know how to use it, I can get value out of it. How do I govern this, right? Because now I have thousands and thousands of models in production, and oversight and management of all of this is not so simple anymore. So what do I do, and how do I do that?
Yeah, I think that's very true. You know, we see a lot about a lot of the new data protection rules, especially around, around the world, right? And this becomes, seems like it becomes a more of a challenge for organizations, because they will essentially, some of them are just using data however they're getting the data, whether it's, you know, a user using their software, or it's somebody walking into an organization, some data about them. And they're using that to produce insights and do other things for their customers, even for their business. But now, with a lot of data protection rules out there, is that creating even more challenges? What are they having to pay attention to more often than not in order to still be effective?
Yeah, so it's interesting, because now with your sort of data protection laws, we are keeping people secure from sort of breaches and all those things. But what's funny is that when a company says, I want to make sure the model I'm building isn't biased, they no longer have that data that they can use to qualify that. And so this is where that sort of trade-off comes to play, where you say, hey, we'd like to collect your data, but for this expressive purpose, to be able to confirm that we're not being biased or the like. And I think that's going to be one of these challenges coming forward. But for now, you know, people are doing what they can with what they have, but there really has to be some sort of middle ground coming in the future.
Right. Now, we're seeing, you know, a lot of fact in organizations where they're trying to hire, they're trying to find talent to actually be able to produce these models. And like you said, we're starting to store more and more data. And, you know, organizations are finding it challenging to be able to scale these efforts now that they have these protection laws they have to deal with. Is there a link between all of these? Is there a way for an organization to say, okay, you know, now I have new hires that I need to help grow in this space and be able to share and teach them how to do this. In the same sense, I have data and I have models that are already out there, but I need to make additional insights into the data, but I'm restricted. I'm still restricted by, whether I should be using the data or should not be using the data. Now, it seems like there's a lot of complexity in there. Is there a way for organization to handle this? What should they be doing?
Yeah, so I think the main thing is realizing that these are not disparate issues. They're all part of a much bigger umbrella when it comes to AI governance, data governance, privacy, security, responsible AI, MLOps, like the list goes on, right? Because you can Google any of these terms and you'll see like tens and thousands of different terms coming up and they all mean the same thing. And so what we're showing on the screen right now is our sort of box of understanding, which I really like. The idea being that if you look at AI governance as a whole, you can understand the value-based issues as well as the operational issues. And these things can work together to actually build better products across the entire lifecycle. So if the data protection laws are something that falls within regulatory compliance, your governance system should capture that and be able to pass that information on to your data scientists, to your data analysts, so they know, okay, I shouldn't be using this data, or I can't access this data for XYZ reasons. And that downstream, or sort of at the beginning and at the end, the MLOps mm-hmm. side of the house can know, okay, this kind of data is coming in, we shouldn't be collecting it, or if it does get collected, it goes straight into this really secure vault. And on the other end, when we're building a model like this or we're putting some sort of product out there, it needs to have these parameters. And so you need all of these things working together. Otherwise, you're just going to get sort of piecemeal solutions. And it's not actually viable for scale.
You know, one thing that a lot of organizations have to pay attention to, and we talked about this a little bit before the show too, is the fact that sometimes these models might carry biases in them, and they could be, and how organizations to know that they do? What are they supposed to be doing here to ensure that they're not carrying these and be able to manage them?
Yeah, so very practically speaking, there's a lot of research that's coming out and things that have been sort of, I would say, approved by the industry at large or the area at large, which is to say measuring whether or not the model is actually performing the same for different groups. You know, and that's one of those things that's like a no-brainer almost. Okay, I built a model. It's 90% accurate. Woohoo, let's put it into production. Well, when you actually look inside and assess how well it performs across your different groups, turns out this model is way better at predicting whatever it is for women than it is for men. And so, sure, it's doing a good job, but it's not doing it equally. Now, that's just one example of sort of group fairness, right? Or one way to cut at the bias issue. There's problems with the way that we look at our data, even use our data, then problems with the way we build our models and assess them, and problems with the way that we even report on them. So practically speaking, there's a lot to look at from that sort of responsible AI ML pipeline thinking. And there are a number of resources now out there to focus on these things.
So obviously once organizations, they start to think about this, they start to think about how they are interpreting their results. They're saying, okay, are these results, are they producing bias results? What are they supposed to be doing after? What's the next step if they determine, okay, now you know they are producing potential bias results? What's the next step for that organization? Do they rebuild the models? Do they retrain them? What's the process they should be taking?
Yeah, so actually, I would say that there's a couple of different options, and there is no one magic bullet, right? But it is a variety of things that one can try out. So the first thing that I do is I go back and I look at the data. You know, is my data even reasonable, right? Does it even match the population I'm trying to work with? Or does it have enough representative samples? These are baseline questions, right? Then looking for, okay, are there proxies? Are there things that might be sort of sneaking in that I didn't realize, unintended sort of correlations? Then after that, I can say, okay, I know my data has bias because all data has bias, spoiler alert. I'm supposed to say it before the spoiler, but spoiler alert, all data is biased. And if that's the case, then we should probably do some sort of techniques on our data to help adjust for that bias. Now, people like to call it bias mitigation. I actually think that's unfair because you're not really mitigating bias so much as you're putting a different kind of bias in to balance things out. And so I wouldn't call it bias mitigation so much as bias balance. And that's one first approach, right? So maybe you do that, you run the model, things are all great, and you've done what you need to do to produce an unbiased model. Sometimes that's not enough. Then there are in-processing and post-processing techniques that you can run onto your machine learning model before it goes out into production so that you know and can feel very confident in sort of the integrity of that model.
Yeah, it sounds like a lot of organizations, they like you were saying, they build these models, they train them, and they feel like, oh wow, they're very, very correct, looks great, let's move forward, and they scale them out and they bring it to production. And I think, like you're saying, they find that, you know, they're not managing them correctly. They're not working through the process of ensuring that they're doing things responsibly, that they're ensuring that things are not biased. And I think that these are all great tips. I want to go more into some of these tips because I think that it will really help organizations, especially ones that are still infant in the stages of developing this process for their organization. So when we come back, we'll talk a lot more, and I'll actually bring my co-host back in because there's lots more to talk about here. But before we do have to thank another great sponsor of this week in enterprise tech, and that's PlexTrack, the security management platform that brings you better reports, deeper assessments, and more insights. Now, do you spend hours and hours reporting security issues and feel like it's getting you nowhere? Are you maybe even buried in data but still can't get a full picture of your security posture or prioritize remediation efforts? We've got the solution for you. Now, PlexTrack empowers continuous assessment, automated workflow, and effective collaboration between teams to help cybersecurity professionals do more in less time. Create assessment reports in half the time and centralize your remediation efforts across all scans, assessments, and audits through powerful risk visualizations, scanner and ticketing integrations, and enhanced analytics to effectively communicate risks in real time. Now, whether red or blue, there is PlexTrack for every security professional to save time and get the right work done. Now, red teams can actually import findings from numerous vulnerability scanners, include screenshots and videos with auto formatting, create customized templates, and export to Word with just one click. And they can streamline the report writing process to deliver better results and reports faster. Now, blue teams can actually customize internal and external assessment questionnaires, synchronize findings with task management tools like Jira Cloud, assign findings to team members, and track status over time. And they can provide attestation of security posture with robust analytics. Now, whether you are a small to medium-sized security consultancy, a full-scaled MSSP, or a large enterprise, security teams of all sizes, specialties will work more effectively and efficiently with PlexTrack. Now, PlexTrack is the premier cybersecurity workflow management and reporting platform for every professional, from practitioner to CISO. Now, there's truly a PlexTrack for every security team. The PlexTrack improves the entire security engagement lifecycle by making it easy to generate security reports, deliver them securely, and track the issues to completion straight from the platform. Book a demo today. Try PlexTrack free for 1 month and see how it can change your life as a security professional. Simply go to PlexTrack.com/twit and claim your free month. That's PlexTrack.com/TWIT. And we thank PlexTrack for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, we've been talking with Trivani Gandhi. She's Senior Industry Data Scientist, Life Sciences and Responsible AI at Data IQ. Now, I do want to bring my co-host back in, Trivani, because they have a lot of questions here, and they want to talk a lot about some of the different topics you've been going through. I want to start with Chibert first. Chibert?
Well, Trivani, I want to talk about your blog article that you did on things like understanding or articulating concepts of AI governance, ML ops, and responsible AI. And you had I'm stealing a little clip from your blog. You start talking about principles, and you have one inefficiency. A rapidly growing stack of projects requires managing more people, more processes, and more technology. Two, risks. Pushing projects into production involves a new set of risks that are very different from development. And then three, legal pressure. These risks have been identified and discussed by regulators around the world, blah, blah, blah. Good article. I'm big Asimov fan, and I'm thinking, could those be the three laws of AI? And should we have a coalition or some sort of organization so that we can be more responsible about how we roll out AI and use AI in the enterprise?
That's a great question, Brian. I will say the article is really good because I had really great co-authors, Paul Murray and Krishna, who helped me, or who basically were the real brains there. I was just the fluff, if you will. I'm kidding. But they did, they really worked. We worked very hard on that. And so if it's a great blog, it's because of them, I think. I will say that the laws of AI, right? What should they be? The thing with Asimov's laws of robotics is that it puts the world into these categories that leave very little room for sort of what-if scenarios or things going wrong. And we can't always plan for every single thing. So rather than saying this is a law, right, which is brings to mind this image of like heavy blocks in the road, I think we should be thinking about this as best practices, absolute knows, right? What are our absolute limits and how are those going to be different for me as someone working in retail versus someone working in the financial services or whatever it might be? And how are we all educating ourselves to actually make sure we're staying aligned? So I appreciate the sort of desire to go to the three laws or like a set of like absolute must-haves. I think those kinds of must-haves will come from some kind of governing body. But for the most part, we're going to have specific regulations, specific understandings based on the context in which we're in. AI is not a black box anymore. It is something that needs a lot of unpacking and that needs a lot of sort of context-driven decision-making. Now, to your other point about sort of a coalition of responsible AI, you know, there are plenty of organizations out there pushing this work forward, pushing for these principles to come through. And a lot of what we see coming out of the EU, at least, is the result of strong work and strong collaboration between researchers, industry, and sort of nonprofit, philanthropic think tank type groups. And one that I personally really like and follow is the Algorithmic Justice League, which was founded by Joy Beluami, one of the co-authors of the first paper that pointed out the biases in image recognition systems and image recognition data sets. So there are plenty more you could find all over. The question now is, how do we take all of this power, all of this, you know, really key, crucial decision and get it pushed up into the regulations? And the EU has been able to do that. And I hope that we can start seeing that in more places as well.
That sounds really cool. One of our listeners in the chat room, Gumby, he was suggesting that we take a good hard look at the USAID's Principle for Digital Development on Humanitarian Development. It's going to be a little tough to bring that up, but there are lots of work being done. And I'm curious. This is just asking for an opinion. The U.S. likes to think of itself as being the leader, but from what I've been able to read, it sounds like the European Union is actually ahead of the game on this. Would you agree? Would you want to speculate on that?
Oh, man. How do I speculate without getting myself into trouble? No, I think that you're spot on. The EU is leading the charge in this, and that's not a bad thing. You know, the U.S. has a number of platforms coming forward, things like what was shared in the chat. I know that federal government has also put out, I'm sorry, not the federal government, but like the DOJ, the DOD have put out principles for the responsible use of AI. And it is something that they are really seriously looking at. It's not an easy topic. It is complex. It requires a lot of know-how that is frankly still a little new in this area. You know, I don't think you have people who've been doing data science for 20 years in the government right now, because data science as that concept is still relatively new. Even AI as that concept is relatively new. So I appreciate that the EU has taken the charge and is kind of setting a path forward so that other places around the world can actually look to them and say, okay, we're going to take parts of that work for us, parts of it that don't work for us. And I was just doing some research on FDA regulations, and it's quite similar. The FDA has their set of principles and guidelines that are specific for drugs to be sold in the US and Japan. But there are also international standards that they kind of align with on some things and have different perspectives on in other things. And I don't see that as an unreasonable way to go about doing things.
Thanks, Cheever. Thanks, Ronnie. So I do want to bring Kurt back in. Kurt?
Lou, thank you very much. I appreciate that. And I do have a couple of questions. You know, I want to explore a couple of things a little bit more deeply with you. And one of them is, you know, what kind of principles should we use to resolve this tension between privacy and more detailed and effective AI models? Because as you point out, there is a tension there. You know, where do we come down? Is the value of AI so great that we should give more weight to more effective training, or should privacy be the primary concern and let the AI engineers work it out as they can?
That's a really good point. And it's interesting that you use the word tension, because it's a word we use at Dataiku a lot too, which is like that tension between I want to do good, useful AI for my business, but then also how do I manage these privacy concerns, legal constraints, regulations, what have you. And I think that the answer is that you live in that tension and you let that tension actually guide better practices on both sides. So why are we concerned about data privacy? Well, stuff gets leaked, stuff gets sold to actors that I don't want my data sold to, and I'm sure a number of other issues that you would know more about than I, Kurt. But that's one side of it. Now, if we have that sort of protected information, it can be used against us, right? Oh, well, we know that you have these qualities that are, you know, not necessarily anything that should be discriminated against, but they're going to go into a model that's going to use that as a reason to deny you a loan or deny you care or whatever it might be. So why not use that tension and say, we're going to actually use both of these things against each other to increase our data privacy practices, to increase the security and governance around how we collect and store and ideally not sell that data. And at the same time, let's collect that data with an expressed explanation to our customer or whoever's using the AI that we collected this data, we ran your model or we built a model or a prediction without it, but we went back and reviewed to make sure that it was still fair across those indicators that you wouldn't want to otherwise be a part of a model. And so I think living in that tension and resolving those two things, again, back from that umbrella of AI governance is kind of where it has to be. I will just say one more thing before you ask your second question. I'm currently editing a book, technical editor for a book written by Brandeis Marshall, Dr. Brandeis Marshall, who's a really well-known CS professor and interested in these questions of tech ethics. And in editing one of her chapters, it kind of occurred to me that we teach tech as a binary. You have zeros and ones, right? But ethics and questions of what should we do, how do we resolve this, they aren't 0-1, right? That's Brandeis right there. And so we should probably, as people in tech, realize that we can code in binaries or categoricals or what have you, but a lot of life is floats, right? Numbers that go on and on and on and on. There are a lot of life is the number pi. We don't even know where it ends. And so we have to be willing to live with some of that ambiguity as well. And if you're interested, you should check out the book and sign up for a pre-order. It's going to be really good.
Very cool. And thanks for that shout out for the book. Now, I do want to ask another question, and it follows on to some of what you said in your response to my last question. We have seen some of the results of these limited models, most clearly, perhaps, in some of the facial recognition algorithms that famously have decided that, you know, people of color or Asian individuals or women all look alike. Primarily, we're led to believe, because all of the people building and informing the models looked kind of like me, you know, European cisgender males. I guess my question is, are the limitations that we have seen so starkly in these facial recognition AI applications inherent in all AI applications? In other words, is the possibility for that kind of limitation there? And, you know, is this a compelling business case for increasing the diversity of your dev teams? I mean, something that goes beyond the, as some people would have it, woke feel good. I mean, is there a compelling business case to be made to make it a more effective model building team?
Yeah, and just want to confirm you guys can hear me okay. I think my internet might have cut out there.
I can hear you just
okay.
Fine.
Okay, great. So I missed part of the question, but I will answer the part that I did hear, which I liked. So the question really is the bias in AI image recognition, is that something that's just an image recognition problem that we need to solve and be good? Or is it something more? And you kind of answered your own question, Kurt, because you said that the AI image rec is built by folks who are probably not thinking about all of those different types of people they should be including in their data and their models. And so I don't think that the bias in AI is just an image recognition problem. And I don't think it's endemic to all AI models. I think it's endemic to us as AI developers, right? We are the source of so many of the problems because we build data. At the end of the day, all data that we produce is a reflection of the bias around us. Then we use that data in some way that either accounts for or doesn't account for the bias. Then we build models and we make choices about those models. What are we going to prioritize as effectiveness measures? What are we going to choose to tune the model as? How are we going to actually make those in processing choices? And then we report out on it and we choose what we show and what we don't show. And so if we really want to cut at the underlying issue of bias in AI, it starts with us. And that's why I'm such a big proponent of not just here's a toolkit, go have fun, but here's actually how you use it. And that's one of my sort of personal passions, if you hadn't already been able to tell.
Well, I've got a personal passion, and I've been an instructor for a while, and I had almost an even 50-50 male to female balance within my lab. But the girls already had a disadvantage. And so I've been pushing them towards things like women in technology, WET. And I know that's one of your soapboxes. And I wanted to give you a chance. What can we do as technology professionals to try and balance things out? And I'd like you to soapbox on that a little bit.
I love it. Brian, I just love coming onto this show because you give me a soapbox and I just climb on up. You know, there's a lot of things about this, right? We talk about the tech talent pipeline, right? And, oh, we need to get more people in the door early on. Okay, sure. So how do you do that? Well, you start teaching women and people of color STEM and these kinds of topics earlier on in their education, right? And now that's a whole thing that has to be sort of resolved at a public level, right? Because education is not in the hands of industry, but certainly they can provide support through all of the different mentorship and coding programs and things. But then it's not just, let's bring them into the beginning of the pipeline. How do you retain them? How do you grow them? How do you help them succeed and become leaders? It's really easy to say, well, I've got 50% women on my team, but you know, they're only speaking up 10% of the time. Or when they do speak up, their voice is just completely ignored. So it's not just about what's visually in front of you. It's also about how you're working with a person, how you're developing them, how you're, developing also the people who are not women, who are not people of color, to be able to listen and actually hear what others have to say. And that's not to say everyone like that. There are plenty of wonderful, cisgender white men, as Kurt put out there. There are plenty of them. I'm talking to two of them, and the third is still a cisgender man. But I'm talking to a lot of great people. But there are also people who don't quite understand their own biases. And I'm probably guilty of the same thing. And so being able to hear the critique and then say, look, we're trying to do something different here. We're trying to build a bigger picture, build a set of new leaders. This is how we can do it together, I think is a really good way to go about it. So it starts at the beginning, but it has to go all the way through. Otherwise, it's just performative for numbers.
Fabulous. And, you know, that's right. You know, we have to not make it negative for the females or people of color to speak up in our teams. I think that's a wonderful goal. And the characters in my book, I'm trying to make sure that the women and people of color have an equal footing and or gender. And let's see if we can weave that better into our entire society.
Please let me edit your book for that.
Oh, that'd be fun. If Kurt and I are actually writing it together and we're targeting it for young adults. Anyway, sadly, we're pretty much out of time. So let's throw it back at Mr. Liu and we can thank everybody that needs to be thanked.
Thank you. Finally, thank you so much for being here. We really, really love having you on. So thank you so much for coming back. Like Chibert said, we're running a little low on time. We do want to give you a chance to tell the folks at home where they can find more about Data IQ, maybe how organizations can get started.
Yeah. First of all, thanks for having me back. This was so much fun. So if you want to know more about Data IQ, which is this platform for everyday AI that is governed and also fun to use, you can look us up at dataiku.com, dataiku.com. And we have a really great blog with all of the content that we've talked about here and much, much more. So please be sure to check it out.
Fantastic. Yeah, it's a really great blog. Really great blog. Definitely check that out. Well, folks, you've done it again. You sat through another hour of the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe. So definitely tune your podcatchers to Twyatt. Before we sign out, we do have to thank all of our co-hosts because you know what? They are the best in the business. We couldn't do the show without them. So thank you again to our co-hosts, starting with our very own Mr. Brian G. Chibert, what's going on for you in the coming weeks and where can people find you?
Well, I'm going to say, Internet didn't drop out on me today, which is a really nice thing. Apparently, all it took was a nice clean swizzle stick to clean the optics that apparently the installer had the optics in his pocket. So anyway, if you want to hear me rant about different things or talk about some of the projects that I'm doing and definitely some of the things that I do in the world of STEM, I throw a lot of it on Twitter. And my Twitter handle is ADVNETLAB, Advanced Net Lab. And that's kind of a hangover from when I was doing a lot of product testing at the University of Hawaii with Kurt and a bunch of other folks. But we've had some spectacular show ideas coming in from our viewers. And our viewers are on every single continent on Earth. And our download viewer in at McMurdo Sound, you guys have changed around personnel there. I don't know who's down there anymore. I don't suppose you'd be willing to drop me an email with a picture of You at McMurdo. Anyway, my email address is Chebert, spelled C-H-E-E-B-E-R-T at twit.tv. And if you'd like, throw it at twit.tv and that'll hit all the hosts. Now, for you PR folks, throw me the booking requests. That way we don't clog up Mr. Liu's mailbox, but we all like hearing your comments and suggestions. Look forward to hearing your great ideas.
Thank you, Chebert. Well, we also have to thank our very own Mr. Curtis Franklin. Curtis, what's going on for you in the coming weeks? Where can people find you and all your work?
Well, as I said, I've got a webinar coming up in the month of November. I just launched a brand new service at Omdia. We had the launch of the Enterprise Security Management Service with a data asset on cybersecurity awareness training. Much more to come there. Preparing for the coming year when we're going to be looking at risk management and monitoring, as well as doing more research on issues like AI and its use in cybersecurity. I'm doing more and more on LinkedIn, so feel free to follow me there. But you can always follow me on Twitter. I'm KG4GWA, and I will absolutely positively be tweeting about everything else that I'm doing over there. So please drop me a direct message if you want to get in touch with me. I'll look forward to seeing you on the internet.
Thank you, Curtis. Well, folks, we also have to thank you as well. You're the person who drops in each and every week to watch and to listen to our show, Get Your Enterprise Goodness. We want to make it easy for you to watch and listen to Get Your Enterprise News. So go to our show page right now, twit.tv/Twyatt. There you'll find all the amazing back episodes, the show notes, the co-host information, the guest information, and of course, the links of the stories that we do during the show. But more importantly, next to those videos, you'll get those helpful subscribe and download links. Support the show by getting your audio version, your video version of your choice, and listen on any one of your devices, because you know what, we're on all of them. And you know what, check it out on your podcast applications as well. Now, definitely after you subscribe, you should definitely share it with your friends, because you know what, we talk about a lot of fun tech topics on this show, and we couldn't do the show without supported subscribers. So definitely share it with them, because you know what, they'll find it fun and interesting as well. Now, you may have also heard, that's right, Club Twit. It's a members-only ad-free podcast service with a bonus Twit Plus feed that you can't get anywhere else. And it's only $7 a month. Now, and one of my own really favorite things about Club Twit is the exclusive access to the members-only Discord channel. We have a lot of fun tech topics talking in there, some really great characters, some awesome channels, lots of behind the scenes, lots of amazing things going on there, some really fun stuff. So definitely check it out, because it's a really great and interesting thing to do. Now join Club Twit and be part of the movement. Go to twit.tv/Club Twit. Now Club Twit also now offers group corporate plans as well. That's great. Corporate group plans. It's a great way to give your team access to our ad-free team tech podcast. So the plans start with 5 members at a discounted rate of $6 each per month. And you can add as many seats as you like. Now, this is a great way for your IT department or your developers or even your tech teams to stay on up to date with access to all of our podcast. That's right. And just like regular memberships, they can join the Twit Discord server and the Twit Plus bonus feed as well. So definitely sign up at twit.tv/Club Twit. Now, we may have also heard, there's also another option. That's right. A la carte option. That's, you partner with Apple Podcasts to make it so you can pick individual shows with ad free viewing. That's right. Single show subscriptions with Apple Podcasts, only $2.99 per show per month. Lots of options, gives you the option to choose the most favorite show on Twit or multiple shows, only $2.99 per month per show. Now, after you subscribe, again, share the show with your friends, because you know what? That's the best way we actually support the show. So definitely have them subscribe. Now, if you've already subscribed, we do this show live on Fridays, 1:30 p.m. Pacific time. That's right. If you want to see the show, see how the pizza's made, behind the scenes, all the fun stuff, definitely check it out at live.twit.tv or twit.tv/live. There we can, again, have all the banter and all the fun stuff at Twit, see the behind the scenes and how we set up the shows, how we bring down the shows, all the fun stuff. Now, if you're going to watch the show live, you can also jump into our weekly IRC channel as well. That's right. There's a lot of fun characters in there as well. The returning characters, longtime characters, and just a really fun place to be and have a great conversation. We got some great conversations and questions from there as well. So definitely check that out at irc.twit.tv. Now, as Cheever said, you can definitely hit us up at twit@twit.tv. But of course, also check me out, twitter.com/LeoMem. Either direct message me or whatnot. I definitely like to get some messages from you about show topics, even some tech topics or enterprise topics. So definitely hit me up there. There I post a lot of my enterprise tidbits, as well as I also have great conversations with people like you. Now, if you want to know what I do during my normal work week at Microsoft, definitely check out developers.microsoft.com/office. There we post the latest and greatest ways you can customize your office experience to make it more productive for you. And definitely check out our new office script, because it's a web way, it's an online way of actually generating macros for your most used processes that you have in your spreadsheets. So definitely check that out, because it makes it easy for you to move that and do that on the web. I also want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to Leo and Lisa. They continue to support This Week in Enterprise Tech each and every week. We couldn't do this show without them. So thank you so much for all their support over the years. I also want to thank all the engineers and staff at Twit. And I also want to thank Mr. Brian Chee just one more time, because he's not only our co-host, but he's also our tireless producer as well. And we really couldn't do the show without him, because he does all the bookings and the plannings for the show. And you know what? We wouldn't have any guests, and we wouldn't be organized without Mr. Cheever. So thank you so much, Cheever, for all your support. Now, before we sign out, we also have to thank our editor for today, Mr. Victor B. Editor Victor, thank you so much for making us look good after the fact, cutting out all those mistakes that we make, because I make a lot of them. So thank you, Victor, for all your support. And of course, I also want to thank our TD for today, Mr. Ant Pruitt. Ant he's a very talented guy. He does a ton of shows, but he has a really great show also on Twit called Hands On Photography. Ant, what's going on for you in the coming week, and what's going on Hands On Photography?
Well, Mr. Lou, I got a question for you. Have you ever taken a shot and put it up on Instagram or something and didn't get a lot of likes on it? Actually, I'm going to
all
answer
the time.
That. No, I'm going to answer that for you. You put a lot of bangers up there. Yours are just fine. But then there's people like me that sometimes they just don't get the love. So I talk about that on this week's episode of Hands On Photography, and just how you deal with that. You know, sometimes your picture is just not the most popular one, even though you love it. But it's all good. It's all art.
Thanks, Ann. I'll definitely have to watch that episode for my shots as well. Well, folks, until next time, I'm Louis Maresca, just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep quiet.
Hey, you don't have to wait till the weekend to get the tech news you need. Join Jason Howell and myself, Micah Sargent, for Tech News Weekly, where we talk to and about the people making and breaking the tech news.